Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Elder, and today our guest has 11 years of law enforcement analysis experience, 7 years of which with the U.S. Army and Army National Guard. He is an active member of both the IACA and Arizona Association of Crime Analysts. He is currently a criminal intelligence analyst with the Pima County Attorney's Office. Please welcome Sean Rambaran. Sean, how are we doing?
I'm not doing too bad. How are you doing today, Jason?
I am doing well. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll just get right into it then. How did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
Well, it really started with my enlistment into the Army. So I started in the Army back in 2010. Even back then, I always kind of had some idea that I wanted to get into public service of some type. So when I got into the Army, I realized that I wanted to do something kind of more intelligent, more than using my brawn or, you know, just running around. So I got into military intelligence, and that was really my eye-opening experience into the intelligence community, both in the military side of it and then the civilian side of it. Active duty for about 4 years, and then I switched into a part-time role with the Arizona Army National Guard, doing the same thing. And that was when I really had a lot more exposure to the police side of it through police departments and sheriff's departments and then other government organizations. So after I completed my bachelor's degree at the University of Arizona, I put in for a couple of positions, and then I got one working for Tucson Police Department as a crime analyst with the Counter-Narcotics Alliance. So that was a lot of fun. Really enjoyed that job, working with the undercover officers, providing support, and then also helping to manage the confidential informant program that they had.
You're an intelligence supervisor with the National Guard. You said it was similar between what you did in the U.S. Army and in the National Guard. What types of tasks are you doing at this time, and how many people are you supervising?
So when I was active duty, I was supervising about 3 or 4 other analysts at a time. And the mission was different between when I was active duty and when I was in the National Guard. When I was active duty, we were focusing on Africa, on basically the entire continent of Africa, except for Egypt. My team specialized in East Africa. So Tanzania, Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia. And we're looking at intelligence reports that are coming in from all different types of sources, whether it's intercepted communications or satellite imagery or diplomatic cables, anything like that. Anytime there was any sort of report of note, we're looking at that, getting as much research and much information as we can, combining that with all the different types of intelligence, and then presenting a report that we would then give to our commander, whoever that might be.
Now, was this more or less a threat assessment type of report?
Part of it was threat assessment. That was actually kind of like our regular duty, was to do threat assessments, specifically around all of the embassies, because that was kind of the biggest American presence in Africa, besides from the NGOs who are kind of everywhere. So we did a lot of threat assessments with the embassies, but anytime there was any sort of special event that came up specifically with terrorist organizations, such as Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab. And then later in my time, we kind of shifted, because that was when the fall of Gaddafi happened in Libya. Then we would kind of shift gears and be like, okay, well, now let's support our commander with whatever they need specific to this kind of one-off event.
And then you said it changed your mission once you came to the Army National Guard?
Yeah. Being in the active duty, we worked in a secure building. You can't bring your phones in. You can't bring any sort of electronics in. We're dealing with classified information, confidential, secret, top secret, all that stuff. Working with the Arizona National Guard, we're only working 1 weekend a month for the most part, and then a couple weeks in the summer. And so we didn't really have the same access to that type of information. And the types of things that we were asked to help out with were more looking at enemy capabilities. So we're looking at, okay, if we see this type of artillery piece, what is the range on that piece? How many rounds can it fire, and how quickly can it fire? What type of rounds it can fire? So it was more kind of on the technical aspect of that. And so some of that information is classified, but a lot of that is open source that you can just find online. So we weren't looking so much into, okay, well, let's look at these intelligence reports, and because we didn't really have access to that. It was more, okay, let's see what we can find, and looking at some military documents too that have a lot of that information and go from there.
And then is it just focused on Arizona at this time?
Well, when I was in my unit, they were just doing regular training, not really for a specific mission, but right as I was getting ready to leave, they were actually getting ready to deploy to Afghanistan. So at that point, all of the training was specific to what they would be doing in Afghanistan. So instead of just exercise type training where it's just okay for just a general enemy X, now it's actually looking at, okay, well, now let's focus towards what we're actually going to be seeing while we're over there. And so I helped them in the lead up to that, but I left the National Guard before they deployed. So I didn't go with them.
So then, as you mentioned, you transition from the National Guard to the Tucson Police Department. So let's talk a little bit about that transition going from the National Guard to the civilian position.
So the funny part about that is that I worked for Tucson Police, but I was assigned to the Southern Arizona HIDA. And so I'm working with other National Guard members who are there on a National Guard specific assignment. And so we're talking military stuff all the time because for a while I was doing both. I was still in the National Guard and working for Tucson PD. So we had a lot of stuff to talk about, and that was really interesting just to see kind of both sides of it. And they're always trying to get me like, oh, well, come be assigned here, stay in the National Guard, and we'll try to get you assigned here. And I was just like, well, you know, I did my time and I'm kind of looking forward to being just a full-time civilian. Okay. So
that's fair. I was going to ask you why you didn't continue.
I'm not ashamed of that. I really like the intel part of what I did. I really enjoyed that. But some of the military specific stuff, it just kind of was like, yeah, okay, I'm kind of over this. Mm-hmm. So is there a way for me to still do the analysis part of it and not really have to worry about the military obligations that you have to do? You know, the waking up super early every morning and shaving my face every day and doing 12-mile ruck marches. So on the law enforcement side, just like, okay, cool. I'm not a sworn officer. I'm a civilian. I can let my hair grow out on my face and still do the analytical side of it. So this was kind of like a perfect fit for me.
Okay, good. Then you're doing counter narcotics and you're dealing with analyzing mobile phones. What surprised you as you were transitioning coming into this position?
For me, it was more just the wide variety of information that I was dealing with. So dealing with the informants and the information that they're providing and then checking that out and then looking at the technological side. Like you said, I was looking at phones that had been recovered through search warrants, and I was trained on Cellebrite. So I was using that to forensically examine phones. And then looking at the drugs that were recovered and looking at how the lab was testing those and seeing which drugs were coming from different sources or were coming from the same source. And then looking at vehicle information that was seen and all the different avenues of investigation. That was just really interesting and really eye-opening for me while I was there.
I started my career in Baltimore about 20 years ago now. We were working on cell phone information, but this is before the time where cell phones were smartphones. And right. So this idea now, when I hear that someone's doing mobile phone examination, just it's so complex now. I would guess that the Cellebrite software helps out with that complexity.
Oh, for sure. It wasn't just myself that was working with Cellebrite. In fact, a lot of the analysts that I worked with, whether they were there from Tucson Police or another agency that was part of the Counter-Narcotics Alliance, we all went through the training. And so we all kind of had a little piece of the pie when it came to the workload. But yeah, it was really interesting just to see the types of information that you could get and the wide variety of phones even that the bad guys are using, because some of them are using top of the line, you know, the latest release for iPhone or an Android. And some of them are using phones who are just like, wait, how did he get this phone? This is a Chinese phone from 2002. Like, okay, I don't know. You know, we're looking through manuals to see which types of cables we need to connect to it. And so.
Now, when you say you split up the work, would you take one phone and then split out the data from there? Is that what you mean by split up the work?
So, yeah. So there were a number of different undercover squads, and each analyst was kind of assigned to a squad. So depending on which squad, which level of investigation brought in the phone, they would send it to their assigned analyst. So whether it was a street level case or whether it was an interdiction case or whether it was a mid-level case, they all kind of went to a specific analyst to kind of keep continuity so that the officers were familiar with the analyst that was doing the work for that specific phone.
As you look back, is there anything else that comes to mind during your time with the HIDTA?
It was really interesting to see how everybody was really cooperative. And I know that's not the case all the time when you have different law enforcement agencies that are doing the same thing. There can be friction and there can be, you know, jealousy or, you know, some other conflicts that come up. But being in that building where everybody is doing the same thing, and it's Tucson Police and it's Pima County Sheriff's Department and the University of Arizona Police even, and then all the federal agencies too, working with Homeland Security and Border Patrol. And they're all, for the most part, that I could see at least, I can't speak in absolutes, but everybody knew, okay, we're all here to catch the bad guys. And it's not about who's going to get credit for it. And my badge is better than your badge, so to speak. Everybody went forward and there wasn't really a lot of infighting while I was there, at least.
Yeah, I've had Richie Martinez and Elise Tkoschak on the show, and they both spent time at the Arizona HIDTA. There is just something in the water there in Arizona, which is funny because it's mostly desert out there. but there is something there about collaboration and working together, and multi-jurisdictional task force just seems to work really well out there.
Sure, for sure.
All right. So then you decide to move on to the Pima County Attorney's Office. So let's talk about that transition. We just had Julie Wortel on the show, and she worked for a time for an attorney's office. So just like to get your perspective on being an analyst in an attorney's office.
So like I said, I was really happy doing what I was doing for Tucson Police and working at the HIDTA and helping out all those counter-narcotics guys. But I know this is the case for a lot of other agencies too. There isn't like a real defined career progression or like a career structure for analysts, unless you're in like a really big agency. So there wasn't like an analyst supervisor position that I could go to, or an analyst two, or like a senior analyst, anything like that. I was kind of in my own island and that was kind of it. And so for a part of me, I was completely happy with what I was doing, but another part of me was just like, well, maybe I should look at some other opportunities, because anytime a new job opened up anywhere, because we had all of the analysts from all these other agencies, they're sending it around like, hey, this CBP position opened up, or this Homeland Security position opened up, or for this agency. And so everybody's talking, and you know, the analyst community, we're all about networking and connecting people to the information that they want. So I had another analyst, her name was Heather Lewis, that she worked with me, and she sent me this posting for the position I'm in right now with the county attorney's office. And my first thought was, wait, they have analysts there? Like, what's the deal with that? Because I didn't really have any sort of experience. And so I was just like, okay, like, what are they wanting to do? And so Heather really encouraged me to go for it. And so I did. And then
you just want to get rid of you.
It's possible. I don't know. But yeah, she was super supportive the whole time. And so, yeah, I went through the process and talked to the county attorney at the time. Her name was Barbara LaWall. She's since retired. She basically had gone to a conference that talked about intelligence-led prosecuting and looked at the examples that had been presented for Manhattan and with the New York, all the boroughs in New York, and then the San Francisco District Attorney's Office. And so she wanted to bring that to Tucson. And so she had this idea, and myself and another analyst, Martin Piatek, we both got hired to basically build this unit. There had already been prosecutors that had been kind of assigned with the intelligence-led prosecuting model. They had been assigned to the geographic divisions around Tucson and around Pima County. But Martin and myself were the first analysts that had been brought into the office specifically for this task. So that was a really neat experience, being able to be like, okay, well, what are we going to do? Well, let's build it. And instead of just, okay, well, this is how it's always been done, or this is the way it goes, it was like, okay, well, let's expand into this. Like, we want to help with this. We want to help with this. And actually blazing our own trail was something that I've never really done before anywhere else in my career.
It's interesting because some people don't like cutting their own path and some people do, right? Some people don't like the fact that there's not already a ladder there to climb. And some people like to establish their own ladder, so to speak. So I think that's fascinating to have the attitude of, okay, let's embrace, let's do this, let's build this from the ground up. Before you get to that, can you give me a good definition of intelligence-led prosecution?
So if you ask a few different people, you're probably going to get a few different answers because there's kind of the broad theme and then the implementation can kind of differ. But the big picture idea is we want to put away the crime drivers, the ones who are responsible for a majority of the crime, the most serious offenses, multiple offenses. We want to more aggressively prosecute them to keep them off the streets for a longer period of time. Because if we keep them away for longer because they are the source of so many other incidents, then it's going to have a better impact on the community instead of treating everybody as, okay, well, everybody's a criminal no matter what. And yes, there are crimes we kind of focus on. We want to have a more impactful way of prosecuting because as an attorney's office as a whole, we can't prosecute every single case and take it to trial and get the maximum sentence just because of limitations with the court system and with workload and time and resources. So we want to basically have an efficient process as we can and make the community as safe as we can.
So does that mean you're taking a more active role of identifying targets instead of maybe what most people would think a prosecution office would do would be police, law enforcement brings the case to them?
So we are kind of identifying target, but we're doing that with the partnership of law enforcement. And that's one of the big things that I do in my job is I'm not just sitting in my office the whole time. I'm going out to the local agencies and I'm going out to task force meetings for burglary, for gang, for auto theft. And I'm meeting with Tucson police and Pima County Sheriff and getting all the information that they are sharing. If I am able to see like, okay, well, this person got mentioned in an auto theft task force meeting and that same person is also breaking into houses on the east side of Tucson because they mentioned them at the east side meeting. And that person is mentioned when I meet with Counter Narcotics Alliance because I actually go back to my old job at the HIDA for their weekly meetings. If we see that somebody is crossing jurisdictions and they're popping up, now it's like, okay, well, now this is somebody we really need to take a closer look at and make sure that not only are the law enforcement people on the same page and they know that, okay, well, this person is popping up for auto theft and narcotics and with the patrol divisions, but now the prosecutor also knows that, okay, well, whenever this person gets picked up, now we know that this is somebody that we want to kind of look at with a closer eye because of all of the attention that he's getting, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. So now, how did you get this established then? And I know it's not just you, it's your partner, but go through some maybe the growing pains of getting this established and building this from the ground up.
So the relationship building is really the first part. Because I was coming from Tucson Police, I already had that built-in relationship where they already at least knew me. The other analyst I worked with, Martin, he was hired from an agency in California. So he had just moved to Tucson, so he didn't really know anybody. The prosecutors already had some sort of relationship with the detectives who would bring cases for issuing. But because I already had that pre-existing relationship, that was our foot in the door. And that got us started to be invited to all of these meetings, these patrol meetings, the task force meetings. If we didn't have that, our development of building our unit here might have turned out a little bit different. So we're really fortunate that, I don't say we're fortunate because it was me, but I'm fortunate that I had that experience that was able to dovetail so well into what I'm doing now. That relationship and being able to know that law enforcement can trust you and you're not just, oh, well, you're just that office that dismisses all these cases that we work on. That was really a big help.
When you go to these meetings, and I'm assuming that there's analysts at the departments that you're visiting, how are you dividing up what they're going to handle in terms of workload and what you're going to handle to make sure that there's not duplication of effort?
Well, all of the analysts that are working for the agencies, they're really working more on pre-arrest. They're really working on identifying suspects, and they're working on, okay, well, there's this trend of vehicle break-ins or, you know, home invasions. There's a drug rip crew going around. They're really trying to identify these people and help the officers know who these suspects are. Where I'm looking at it is more, okay, we know who this person is. When they get picked up and they get arrested and they get booked, now our office is going to be dealing with this. So now the police analyst's job is kind of done, because they identified them, the officers arrested them, and now they're on to the next case. And so that's where that handoff happens, so that I'm not really working on trying to identify suspects, and the police analysts aren't really working on how to better prosecute these suspects. So at the time of the arrest, that's when we have the handoff. So because that line is so clear, there's not really any duplication of effort.
Okay, good. And I see here you've developed a couple of databases for them as well during your time here. And I thought that was interesting too, because that's what Julie talked about. Julie developed a mapping program during her time with the attorney's office. So what types of systems have you set up since you've been there?
So there's been two that we've set up since I started. The first one was an arrest alert database. And so this was something that we had heard about from another agency, from another prosecuting agency, where they wanted to have a way to notify officers that somebody had been picked up. And so when we talked to the analysts in New York, for example, they're really fortunate in the sense that they only deal with New York police. So their entire geographical area is one police department. In Pima County, we have Tucson Police Department, we have Pima County Sheriff, we have Marana Police, we have Oro Valley Police, we have University of Arizona Police. We have all these different agencies. Plus we have Native American Reservations Police. And then we have all the federal agencies. And we have all of these agencies that are all within our county. I mean, our county itself is as big as the state of New Hampshire.
Wow.
So we wanted to create a way so that if one agency is tracking somebody and wants to know when they get located, when they get booked, and then another agency is the one that actually catches them, where is that connection going to be made? And so because we're the central agency, because we are servicing the entire county, we created this arrest alert system where some officer says, hey, I want to know when this person gets picked up for whatever reason. So we put their name into our arrest alert system. Whenever they get booked by any agency, as long as it's within Pima County, when that booking feed comes to our office, because we're going to know whenever anybody gets booked, because we're going to have to do the initial appearance, that is going to send an alert, which is either going to be a text or an email or both, to whoever wants to be notified of this specific defendant. Hey, this person got picked up. These are the charges that they got picked up on. These are the people that wanted to know about this person being located, being into custody. So I think that's been the biggest feather in our cap right now, because that's helped so many, not just cases where we're looking for defendants and we're trying to find bad guys, but that's also helped out our own internal investigators, where if we're trying to find a victim or a witness who needs to testify in a case and they get picked up on a number of charges, then our detectives can go and speak to them about their testifying in a trial or you know, whatever else they're needed for. And that actually happened in a murder case. I want to say it was a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, back when we were having regular trials. The witness got picked up. I want to say it was 4 days before the trial started. If that witness wasn't there to testify, who knows what would have happened with the case. As it turned out, it ended in a guilty conviction.
Well, let's talk about your badge story now. And for those that are new to the show, the analyst badge story is the career-defining case or project that an analyst worked on. So yours is still being prosecuted, so there's only so much detail that we can go into, but let's just generally talk about the case and what you did to help solve the case.
So this was the big task force project, and I had just started here in this position. I'd only been here for a few months, and then I was told to like, hey, we're going to have you go help out with these guys over at this meeting. So I'm like, okay, I don't really know what's going on. So the task force had been created because there was a number of ATM robberies and associated crimes. They had almost the same MO, and they had been occurring for about 15 months. And so this task force was developed because the incident locations were across different jurisdictions. Some were in the city, some were in the county. There were some that were even, one was in a neighboring county. We were pretty sure it was the same group of people. So as I got more familiar with the case and what was going on, we were able to identify the main suspect. But there were, at the time, seven other people that were associated, but we didn't know their level. We didn't know if, okay, is this person just a friend, or is this person an accomplice? Is this person a lookout? We didn't really know what the involvement was. After a few weeks, things escalated in the case, and we eventually were able to locate and arrest the main suspect. And then came all of the work after that. So there were, I want to say there were 9 cell phones that were seized, search warrants were served on. So it wasn't just the phones themselves that were examined, but now we're looking at call detail records for 15, 16 months, or as long as we could go. And so that was where they're like, hey, can you help us out with this? Because this is a lot of stuff. And so, you know, I was like, of course, you know, I'll help however I can. And so I helped look through the records. And so I'm looking at location data, looking at to see, okay, well, what matches up in terms of tower locations with crime locations. And then we're looking at calls, because we're pretty sure that for a number of the incidents, because there were a total of, I want to say 45 incidents. We're pretty sure that somebody was on like a police scanner app and would notify them as soon as a call went through of like an alarm trip or something like that. So now we're looking at, okay, well, who's calling who at the time that the crime likely occurred, or who's texting or whatnot. So that was just a lot of data to go through. And that helped us differentiate between, okay, well, this person is, he was just a friend. He wasn't really involved, that we can determine. But this person, he was there for, you know, however many number of incidents, and we can place him with certainty at least these two locations. And so this person's going to pick up charges also. So working in that task force and then being able to definitively say, okay, well, these are the charges we need to pursue because of this evidence, that was kind of the most fulfilling part of that for me. I can't really talk about it in detail again because it's still being adjudicated, but the main suspect is facing over 70 felonies. So,
okay, wow. Yeah, and I think it's always interesting that several people on the show now have talked about the pattern of life analysis. When you got a cell phone and then you have an incident in time, and then you see how the activity on their cell phone changes once that particular event takes place.
Yeah. And that was actually a little bit difficult for us to determine because we're trying to establish pattern of life. And it wasn't until later in the investigation, before we had located and arrested the main suspect, we didn't know where he was staying. It turned out that he was actually staying in like a 18-wheeler, just like the truck part of it. And so he was moving and just parking it somewhere, and he would sleep there and then move it again in a couple of days. And so until we realized that, we were kind of pulling our hair out. Like, where is this guy staying at? Like, you need to try to figure out if we can pin him down. And then once we had that information, then we're like, oh, okay. Well, that explains why we weren't able to figure it out immediately.
What would your advice be if an analyst gets in this situation for the first time and they get brought into an investigation and said, okay, here's 10, 15 phones. Here's the data. Go.
My first piece of advice is to ask questions. You want to make sure that before you're dealing with something of that magnitude, of that amount of work, you want to make sure you're doing what they're actually asking for you. You want to make sure that, okay, well, let me just make this perfectly clear. You want me to do A, B, and C with these and D, E, F with these. So it would just be terrible to go through a bunch of work and spend a lot of time and then realize that that's not what they're looking for. So make sure that whatever the ask is, you're perfectly clear on what you're doing. I would say the second thing is to see if there's any ways to make that type of work easier. I mean, as analysts, we always look for like automation, if there's any way to make it a little bit easier for us, because otherwise you're just going to be looking at row A, click, row B, click, row C, click, and you know, it gets kind of tedious that way. So if there's any way that you can use technology to make it a little bit easier for you, I would definitely look into that also.
Was there a software that you used?
There were a couple of different programs that we used. One that the police department was using, and then one that we were using. So they were using ZX, and then we were first looking at GeoTime, and then with CellHawk. Mm-hmm. To look at all of the CDR records and then to display or chart the relationships between who's calling who and who's texting who between all of the phones that we had recovered.
And anything else?
I think that's about all I can talk about with that case right now.
Okay, that's fine. All right, well, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about IACA bylaws because you're leading the charge on some bylaw changes. Bylaws aren't necessarily an exciting topic, but they're also important for the association. So we want to address this and go over what you're trying to do. You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Brian Gray, and my advice for analysts is don't settle for mediocrity. If you want to be happy in this career, long term, you can't be a minimalist. Just don't do what you're asked for. Do what you know is right. And don't ever, ever substitute quantity for quality. And if you haven't found a way to put design to work for you, you're not doing your best work.
The textbook, Exploring Crime Analysis. This is a good time for me to plug. I am running a contest right now. In my chapter on Excel, I have put an Easter egg in that chapter from years ago. And if you can identify the Easter egg, email us at leapodcasts@gmail.com. The first one I will send a $20 Amazon gift card for. Welcome back, Sean. Now I want to talk about IACA bylaws. You're on the bylaws committee. If I would ask the membership about bylaws, I'm pretty confident that not very many people have probably would know where to go to get them or even have read them or anything like that. Not an exciting topic to talk about bylaws, but us in law enforcement should also realize is that rules and regulations are important. So let's talk about bylaws a little bit and get into some of the issues that you've discovered and your solutions to fixing some of those issues.
So I will be the first to admit that bylaws are not the most exciting thing. They're not the sexiest thing to talk about. They can be very dry. That's full disclosure. The reason that we are looking at making these changes is because what is currently in the bylaws can cause some problems. And so what we want to do is make it so that all of these problems get cleaned up now, and we don't have to make changes to the bylaws every 6 months or every year. So we're trying to get everything kind of standardized and taken care of now. There was an outside parliamentarian who was hired by the IACA a few years ago to look at the bylaws and look at all of the things that could be improved upon. And she came up with this huge list, and then nothing kind of happened. It just kind of sat there. When I got recruited to help with the bylaws, that was kind of our starting point. So we didn't start from nothing. We already had kind of a few suggestions to go on, and we decided, okay, let's see if we can make sure there's no problems here.
What are the big issues that you're seeing and trying to correct?
So the big issues are that all of the operational details are listed in the bylaws. That is problematic. If we have, for example, a pandemic that is going to affect the dates of the annual meeting, which is at the annual conference, those dates were put in stone in the bylaws. And so if we have to move the conference later in the year, as we're doing this year, then that's going to throw off everything if we have to abide by the bylaws. And the bylaws say this specific date must happen. So there's also incidents in the bylaws where there are specific ways that things should be run, and those processes have changed. we want to basically mirror the United States Constitution. The U.S. Constitution is just your backbone. It's going to tell you this broad general overview of what is going to happen. We don't need to put changes to the speed limit in the Constitution. And so all of the operational details for how the elections committee works or how the ethics committee works, those don't need to be in the bylaws. The bylaws should be general, and all of the specific details should be in the charters of these other committees. So with the amendments, that's the end goal.
Okay. And the charters are easier to fix or easier to change, right?
Absolutely.
The executive board can approve changes to the charters. When it comes to the bylaws, though, that process of changing the bylaws takes a membership vote, correct?
Yes, it does. And like you said, the charters can be much more easily amended than the bylaws. So anything that's going to change, any sort of date-specific information with the conference, with elections, we want to take that out. Put in the charters. The charters are updated every year anyways. The bylaws should just be for general information.
You're making this change now to the bylaws. So there's a process in place to make changes, right? And going through them. So I guess let's start there with what is the process to change a bylaw?
So that is one of the things that is in and of itself a change that we're proposing. Because as of right now, there is no clear process for how a bylaw can be proposed. And so by the letter of the law, which for this specific interpretation would have to go by Robert's Rules of Order, any proposed amendment theoretically could go to the membership for a vote as it stands right now. So if I wanted to change the name of IACA to the International Sean Rambaran Fan Association, there's no way for people to vet that and be like, well, that doesn't make any sense. It would have to go to a vote. So one of the things that we're actually doing is making a mechanism in place so that that's not the case. Not anybody can send a bylaw out that would then automatically have to go to the membership for a vote. So we're adding in a level of review there specifically for how to propose bylaws. But in terms of where we are right now, this was brought to my attention last year. And so it's not just me. I am the chair of the bylaws committee, but I also work Levi Girard and Alexander Gould. And so they're my other committee members. And so we've looked at not just what the parliamentarian from a few years ago made for suggestions, but then we've also talked to all the members of the executive board. So Kristen Lottman was the one that she's our board liaison. She kind of helped answer a lot of questions for me. And then obviously talking with Annie Mitchell and Mary Berticelli, and then Rachel Carson and Rhonda also, getting their feedback as far as this is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. Does it make sense for you? So everything that we have put forward has a rationale. It's not just, oh, because I said so. There's a specific reasoning, whether it's something as trivial as punctuation and the format or the style versus something as serious as we don't know what's going to happen in this situation. So I don't remember exactly if it was on one of your earlier episodes or something I see on the forums, but someone had made the suggestion of, okay, well, if the entire executive board is unable to serve for whatever reason, whether they're the subject of an ethics investigation or whether they all resign at the same time, what happens from there?
Yeah, that was Rhea Gerstenkorn, who is the chair of the ethics committee. And she didn't realize that that was the case, that it probably would go back on her if she would have to make the decision, because there's nothing in the bylaws that state how the association should behave.
And so that's one of the things that we've added in there. So basically, in case of emergency, break this and look at this bylaw. And so what we've proposed, again, after speaking with the executive board and a few other people, we've basically said that in the event that the entire board cannot fulfill their duties for whatever reason, then we would look at all of the chairs of all of the other existing committees, and then whoever had the longest tenure in that position and with IACA would then become the acting president. And then the next one would be VP of administration, VP of membership, so on and so forth.
Okay.
So that's one of those things where it's just like, I don't know what happened. Like, what would we want to do? And so we thought that that would be a good solution in the highly unlikely but still possible case that that happens.
Okay, good. I'm glad that got addressed. And so with this change that you're talking about, there's a special section on the forums talking about this. And you give 30 days for there to be a discussion about this particular change. And then it goes to a voting stage, correct?
Yes.
And then during the voting stage, I think, as you mentioned yesterday in the prep call, you can still have dialogue and questions and answers. But there's let's drive home what the difference between when it's the voting period and then when it's the discussion period.
So the discussion period, the 30 days after I had made the announcement on the forums, we could discuss any of the questions that any of the members may have about what we're doing or why we're doing it. And we could still make changes to what we are putting forward. Once that discussion period closes and now we move forward to the voting period, we can still talk about it. And I have made myself available to all of the membership by forum post or by email. Nobody's really taken me up on that because, again, bylaws aren't the same. But once that happens and we're in the voting period, we can still talk about it, but now we can't make any changes. At that point, once we discuss it, it's just a yes or a no to the proposed amendment instead of, okay, well, let's kind of tweak it to look like this.
And I would really encourage members to at least take some time to look at the forum post and the information that's being proposed. Because I know, based on the changes that were made the last time, there was some things that I didn't necessarily agree with that went into law. And so I really encourage folks to read, review, and make sure you understand what's being proposed here.
And I know a lot of the documents can be kind of hard to find, or looking for things on the website as it's kind of been transforming over the last few months can be kind of difficult. But in that forum post, I've put down the current version of the bylaws as they stand right now, all of the proposed amendments that we're offering, and then how the bylaws would look if all of those proposed amendments are approved. So you can look at all of them. And like I said, they have the rationale for all of the amendments. Why are we doing this? It's not just a blank, oh, well, let's just put this forward and see what happens. There's a reason for it, whether that reason is style or punctuation, or if there's a legal reason, like there is some portion that we're changing because it leaves the ISCA open to lawsuits if we don't change it. So that's all there. And if you have any questions going through that, I'm always here for you. You can email me bylaws@iaca.net. And we can put my office email and desk phone also in the episode description if anybody wants to call me or talk to me. I'm here for everybody to answer any questions you might have.
Very good. So when do you anticipate us voting on these bylaw changes?
So I initially had made the post at the end of March. So we're not going to say exactly 30 days. We're going to give it a few more, but I believe we're going to start voting the first week of May. So I believe it's going to be Monday, May the 3rd is when we're going to start. And then the voting period is going to be open for 2 weeks. So during that time, if you have any questions, bring them up. Otherwise, you can vote on all of the proposed amendments or some of them or none of them, whatever you want. But the vote will be determined by the voting members, not just all of the members. So those who actually share their voice are the ones that are actually going to be impactful.
You confused me there. So can anybody vote, or is it any member?
Let me clarify. So the results are based on the people that vote. So the entire membership can vote, but if you choose not to, then we're not going to say that, okay, well, out of the thousands of members, we need 1,000 votes to pass.
It's just
whoever decides to vote, we're going to look at their choices, yes or no. And then it's a 2/3 vote needed to pass an amendment.
So 2/3 of the membership or 2/3 of?
2/3 of the voting.
Whoever votes. Okay. Yes, I see now. And do we vote similar to how we would vote for an executive board member position?
Yes. So the only difference is that, you know, there's the possibility in an election that you have three or more candidates for a position. But I'm going to be talking with Manny San Pedro next week, actually, along with Kristen, to make sure that the ballot is as clear as it can be. And so it will basically say for proposal number one, a yes vote means that we're going to add this language to the bylaws, or we're going to change this language, or we're going to remove this language. And then a no vote will have no effect. And then you just vote yes or no. And then you move on to proposal number two, yes or no, with the same type of description. So that should make it pretty clear for everybody as far as each item that you're going to be voting on.
Good. Is there anything upcoming that you're working on? Like after we get past this vote, is there anything upcoming in terms of the bylaws?
Well, once the bylaws are approved, hopefully, now we can take the changes and now pass all of the charters to reflect the changes that have been made. So at that point, it's going to be more on Mary and each of the committee chairs to go over their charters and make sure that they're updated and they have all of the information that we are now taking from the bylaws and moving to the charters.
Okay. So I guess once the results are in, is the impact immediate?
Yes.
All right. Is there anything else that you want to say about bylaws before we move on?
I know it's really dry, but I'm still encouraging everybody to vote when the voting period opens up in May. And again, if you have any questions about any part of this process or any of the details, feel free to reach out to me.
Good work on that.
Thank you.
So I do want to talk a little bit about the Arizona Association, because you've only been with the IACA and the Arizona Association since 2018, but I do see that you have been awarded with the Arizona Association of Crime Analysts the new analyst of the year in 2018 and the innovator of the year in 2019, which is pretty impressive. So what did you do to get the new analyst award, and what did you do to get the innovator award?
So for the Arizona Association of Crime Analysts, I mean, that's something that I had been aware of when I worked at Tucson Police, but I wasn't really involved with. I wasn't a member until I joined my current position here. So after I got into this position, I was hired. My first thought was like, okay, are there any other prosecuting agencies in Arizona that have analysts? And luckily there was, with Maricopa County, which is the Phoenix area. So I was able to talk to a couple of analysts there. I talked with Debbie McKenzie, who at the time was the president of AACA. And I also talked with Aaron Wickersham, who is currently the vice president. They kind of were able to connect with me and, hey, we're having this meeting, you should come up for it. And so that was how I got involved with AACA. And then as part of that membership, because they're one of the recognized regional associations, that's how I got into IACA. And then right about that time, they asked me if I wanted to fill a vacancy on the board, which I did. So I became the vice president of AACA, which is basically the person who is responsible for organizing all of the training events. So because myself and Martin were new analysts in the eyes of the AACA as new members, we were nominated and won the new analysts of the year. We shared that award. And then as the vice president for the next year, organizing all the training events, I wanted something that was going to be kind of fun to do and something that's a little bit more memorable instead of just sitting through a lecture or a PowerPoint presentation or something like that. So I was trying to think of ways that we could stretch our analytical muscle, but do it in ways that were kind of unique. So just as an example, one of the things we did when we met for a meeting is I separated all of the attendees into like five separate groups, and I gave them a bag, and the bag had a bunch of puzzle pieces in it. So it was like 100 pieces. I said, okay, you guys are going to have a different puzzle and you guys are all going to have to work on it. So there's like six people to a team, but you don't know what it is you're working on. Like, you don't know what the picture is. And so that's supposed to kind of mimic a lot of the work we do, where we don't know exactly what the outcome is going to be, but we still are trying to put pieces together. And then as a little wrinkle, I said, oh, and by the way, one of the pieces from all of the other puzzles is in your bag. So now you have to coordinate with the other teams to figure out which piece belongs to them and which piece of theirs belongs to you, which is supposed to kind of mimic the way that we reach out to other agencies, to other analysts, because criminals don't tend to stay in just one area in a neat little box. So that was just kind of one of the examples of something that I put together. All it costed me was some Ziploc bags and some dollar store puzzles. And a lot of people really liked that type of training. And again, it's putting together puzzles, but you're still analyzing and you're still working together and you're still communicating. And that was one of the things that was mentioned when I was nominated and won the Innovator of the Year.
Yeah, I would say that is innovative. Good deal.
So if anybody wants to steal that idea, go right ahead. It's not copyrighted or anything like that. I won't get mad.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about personal interests to finish up. I don't want people leaving here thinking that you're the boring bylaws guy. And so you're a sports fan. So what are you watching these days?
So I really like baseball a lot. I will play or watch really any sport, but baseball is probably one of my favorites. So I'm a big fan of the Diamondbacks. And if anybody I meet in the analyst community is a baseball fan, I will always kind of lead the conversation that way. I know I was just talking with Joe Ryan, who's over in Auburn, Washington. He's with NorCan. I was talking with him and he's a big Mariners fan. And so as soon as I met him, I met him a few years ago, but we were just talking recently. And so we're always going to be talking about baseball and the way the Mariners are going, the way the D-backs are going. So that's just a lot of fun for me. I play in a league also. So I'm on a men's team here in Tucson. And then I've been doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu for a little over 10 years now. And that's a lot of fun for me also. A way for me to try to stay in shape and then also, you know, simulate murder, which is always fun.
Well, that's memorable now. So, all right. All right. Well, very good. Our last segment to the show is Words to the World. And this is where I give the guest the last word. Sean, you can promote any idea that you wish. What are your words to the world?
So it's kind of be two related things. So the first one is really value face-to-face communication. I know with the pandemic, face-to-face might be looking through a computer screen, but just knowing who you're talking to and appreciating that, I think that's something that we're kind of losing in just a busy world when we can just do something in a text message or we can do something in an email. So really, really value that interaction, because I think that's something that's kind of going away. And now somebody, instead of a name and a person, is just going to be a number. The other thing is kind of based on that, don't argue on the internet because you will never win. So if you're have an opposing viewpoint on any issue and you're arguing with somebody on Facebook or Twitter and you don't know them, just don't even get into that. Don't even get into that, you know, that argument, that discussion that is going to turn into an argument, because that person doesn't know you. You don't know them. Just save yourself the stress and just ignore it.
Very good. Well, I leave everybody with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. I do appreciate you being on the show, Sean. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Thank you very much, Jason. Take care.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Elder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.